Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everybody. It's Sam Hankin, host of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Ben Perkert, author of The Men Can't Be Saved, published by Overlook and released just last month. Ben's previous work is the poetry collection For the Love of Endings. His stuff appears in The New Yorker, The Nation, and elsewhere. He's also the founder of Backdraft, which is a Guernica interview series. It's focused on revision, which I like to do, never really works, and the creative process. So, hey, remember the year of the Depend adult undergarment and David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, or Ignatius Valve in The Confederacy of Dunces? So Seth, our protagonist, has elements of both. He wrote a slogan that deals with the former, the adult undergarment, and he lives a life that kind of mimics the latter, and that he has a kind of vow that he uses to make sure he doesn't blame himself and also to take credit for things he might not necessarily should do. So it's lots of fun pretending that you're not as misshapen or weak as you are by making excuses as you cruise through a somewhat pitiful life. But if slogans can elevate you to a status that you cherish, men's diapers is a strange, but in this case, an appropriate acknowledgement. So Seth's life is full of travail and a bunch of girls that really don't like him, but with an exception are willing to have sex with him, seemingly enjoying it. Coupled that with his mentor, friend, and nemesis, Moon, who has his own panoply of issues, and you get a barrel of laugh-out moments through the book. And then, like, towards the end, you start thinking, hey, wait a minute, maybe this is all more important than it seems at first glance. You know, so like, is it like a life you wouldn't want to live is a waste or isn't it? Or does it hold potential? So welcome, Ben, and thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, so you have some great blurbs on the book, which are kind of like branding. So why don't you exercise, blurb your own book, or better yet, pitch it. Let's see what you do.
Oh, interesting. You want me to, I got out of the advertising biz and now you're pulling me back in for my own book. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Well, the shortest version of the book that I could possibly give you is that a young copywriter thinks he's hot shit, but maybe isn't quite as hot as he thinks he is, and has one viral moment that goes big, and then we just watch him spiral down from there. So, I mean, I love a good spiral. I loved Mad Men, and I loved, you know, watching Don Draper from season to season sort of, you know, go from debonair at the very beginning to where he ends up. So maybe the book will appeal to folks who like that.
Yeah, it reminded me on a smaller scale of that last episode, I think it was, when, you know, the Coke commercial, I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Yep. Yeah.
That still gives me, it's like so weird. That still gives me not like chills, but like this really warm feeling that this is like, and then you realize this means nothing. But back then it was really cool because it had diversity before diversity was cool. And it had this song that just kind of like, and then everybody in Mammon was very proud of that. So why don't you take off from that and talk about how Seth comes up with the slogan that gives him his Swarovski crystal and seemingly to him moves him into like hero status.
Yeah.
Talk about the commercial itself because it's hilarious.
Yeah. So on the very first page, you find out as the reader that Seth has, you know, has this sort of singular bullet on his resume that he's really, really proud of. Right. And all it was that when he's at the agency, there was this client that no one wanted. Who wants to work on a, not just like an adult diaper campaign, but like a tiny brand that no one's ever heard of, right? So all the good copywriters, all the good designers, they get the Coca-Colas, the Googles, the Apples, they get the big accounts. Seth gets stuck on this quite literally shitty account. But, you know, he comes up with a tagline that hits it big. Everyday briefs for the everyday hero. And the ad that gets made is about this strapping older guy in the woods who's chopping down a tree. And, you know, you think it's just sort of a beer commercial that's hyper masculine. And then you find out that he's crapped his pants. And so he's wearing one of these adult diapers. So, you know, I think early on as the reader, you're left wondering, like, who is this guy? And does he really believe, is he really proud of this moment? Or does he have some self-awareness that this is kind of a ridiculous thing to hang your hat on? And that question of, wait, is Seth in on the joke? Does he have any awareness? Can he see himself at all? I think that's one of the through lines, actually, that keeps you reading.
Yeah, and that's what Josie keeps telling him. And
right.
The other, you know, Yael and Ramya. But the thing about the funniest thing on the first page to me was that, you know, I thought, okay, this is kind of cool. It's like an old guy like me, but he's in good shape. He's walking through the woods. The key part is he touches the tree as if he's recognizing, like the old man in the sea. He's fish, but at the same time, they have this camaraderie. And then he has to do what he has to do and then shoves it in his truck. And the funniest thing was he didn't do any of that. And I thought, okay, that's kind of cool. He did this, but he didn't. He just did the tag.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, you know, so I worked in, I say branding / advertising and use them interchangeably, even though they're not really. You know, the agency that I worked at was specifically branding. And so I would come up with a lot of taglines, but I would never do the advertising. The advertising was a different agency. But folks in branding, we always thought that what we did was superior. Similarly, the advertising folks always thought what they did was superior, right? Because the ad guys are actually making the ad. They're the ones who, at the end of the day, if you're going to buy the Super Bowl spot, you know, they're going to film it. But we were the ones doing the brand strategy. We would come up with the line. So yeah, you know, Seth is only responsible for a tiny percentage of this campaign's success, but he tells himself that he is the architect of all of it. You know, he's the genius behind it.
Well, if you think of, like, you know, I thought of this a lot throughout the book because they just came into my head. Like I was saying about Coke, it's the real thing. Or in the book, talk about I'm Loving It from,
yep.
And then stuff like, you know, Cars for Kids or We Are Farmers or Liberty, Liberty, Liberty. And I'm thinking, none of these are any good. Why are they successful? Why are they, especially Cars for Kids? Why are we able to, in our own minds, make this the way that we remember it, even if we don't want to?
Yeah.
And that goes to your epigraphs, which we'll talk about, and the cover, because I'm a bookseller. You know, that's what sells books.
Speaking of which, hi. Let me show it prominently.
Yeah, hold it up. So yeah. Hold more, because you're branding your book. So if you hold
exactly.
It
up. Exactly. There we go.
Yeah.
Nice. So,
did you vet the cover? Did you come up with the cover?
Oh, man. The cover was a long process. So, you know, if folks are interested. So, and by the way, Overlook / Abrams, they were great, because a lot of publishers, they don't give a shit what the author has to say. And we were very collaborative. But early on, they showed me this illustration just of a handshake, sort of just a black and white handshake, no fire at all. And it felt very Mad Men. It felt like business, but the way that, like, business used to be done, it felt a little antiquated. And so I didn't really love it. And so we went through all these iterations and nothing was feeling right. And I just said, you know, can we go back to the handshake? And what if we did something to it? What if we rendered it with a little bit more heat or tension? Like, what if it was almost like a Mephistopheles, you know, making a deal with the devil kind of moment? And that's when the fire came in. And I loved the font, everything. So everything fell into place after that. So I don't take credit for it. It was the designer, Eli Mock. He does an amazing job. But it took a while to get there, because I didn't want the book to feel like historical fiction, advertising the way that it was. The book is more or less contemporary. So it needed to feel more present.
Yeah, it's funny, because every interview I talk about the cover and the epigraphs, because as a bookseller, people come into my shop, they have no idea what they want to buy.
Right.
The reason to buy it is because of the brand, the cover.
Right.
And the reason why publishers do their own rather than the author is because they want to sell the book too.
Mm.
The author's idea, because that's not what you do. It's like a chef becoming a businessman.
Yeah.
And yeah, so this is a cover that you're drawn to, not only because of the font, because of the color and the concept of making a deal with the devil.
Mm-hmm.
Like Seth does. He spends a lot of time trying to find words that have permutations.
Mm.
You know, like he specifically spends a lot of time finding meanings in words that are like portmanteau kind of things.
Yeah.
Is that something that you did? Is that something that's an important element of creating a brand?
Oh yeah, certainly for the tagline. And part of, I'll just say, you know, what was both fun and also a challenge for me was reminding myself, I'm the author of this book. I'm not the branding expert. You know what I mean? So yeah. I came up with the title, I can't be the architect of the brand strategy for the book. That's not my job. Even though on some level, because I've worked in that industry for a while, it kind of gets into your brain, you know? But yeah, I mean, one of the things that when I was working in at the agency, a good tagline was a tagline that could go in 1,000 different ways, right? So something like, I'm just making this up, you know, forward for tomorrow, or, you know, the way the future flies, or something where you're just like, your brain can both means nothing and everything at the same time. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. And
go ahead.
No, it sometimes felt like that was what a tagline was supposed to do. You know, was Matthew Zapruder has this poem where he talks about how Diet Coke tastes delicious. It tastes like everything, but then if you think about it, it tastes like nothing. It's just that sort of synthetic language that, you know, you could take a tagline like forward for tomorrow. You could slap it on a Toyota. You could slap it on IBM. You could slap it on almost anything. And it makes a certain amount of sense, even though it's really bullshit, right? It's not actually saying anything.
Yeah. Well, then there's ones that you don't even know why. It's like you're too young maybe to remember this, but it's like Good and Plenty. Good and Plenty slogan was plenty good.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. But yeah, it was a great slogan. I have no idea why. And yeah. Then I was thinking about like Umberto Eco, and I was thinking about semiotics.
You know,
signs and symbols. It's like if you get in a cab in New York in the old days when everyone knew where things were, you could just hold your hand up, the cab comes, you get inside, you go Penn Station. That's it. He goes to Penn Station, you hand him some money. There's no real communication yet. It's perfect. The whole situation is perfectly branded.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, to go back to your Good and Plenty example, what I'm describing is when I was at the agency, you know, I worked there during the lowest point of the recession. So we were terrified of losing clients. Clients were terrified of losing business. All of that, I think, those are fertile conditions to make really shitty art because everyone is afraid, right? So a line like forward for tomorrow is not a good line, but it's a safe line. If you think about some of the taglines that have endured, they are really weird. Like BMW's tagline is the ultimate driving machine.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like something a German robot came up with. Like it's a very unusual tagline. It doesn't sound persuasive at all, but it feels very engineering. It feels very German. It's sticky because it's so weird to the American ear. So I think that a lot of great taglines are the ones that don't, you know, you hear them and you sort of say, what? But something about that questioning is actually what sinks the language into your brain a little bit more.
Yeah. And it's funny because for whatever reason, Josie, Seth's girlfriend, kind of girlfriend.
Yeah, kind of.
She trashes Lexus. Mm-hmm. And doesn't really have a good slogan either. And
yeah.
Toyota doesn't either. And I never really understood them, and they don't really move me in any fashion. But they've hung on for a long time. And I think it's like what Moon says. It doesn't really, like you said, it doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't mean anything at all.
Yeah.
Yet it becomes part of it doesn't become part of our parlance. Is it just the familiarity that because it has it, you know, like Liberty? I mean, those commercials are so disgusting. And they're everywhere. You can't not. I don't know how they spend all this money, but Liberty is the worst insurance company in the world. They charge the highest premiums. It's just like you're talking about. So at Liberty, 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 Liberty. I mean, how? Why?
Yeah. And yet here you are plugging them in a way, right? I mean, it's.
I'm thinking about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what to say other than the fact that. But, you know, I the I was aware of the fact that all I wanted when I worked at the agency was for me to have that viral moment. I mean, Seth, even though he's a lovable fuck up, he's far more successful in his career than I was. I can't point to a single tagline that I had that really took off. But I also think it's got to feel pretty strange, right? If you're the author or the architect of a line like the Liberty line or whatever else, I think it maybe lives with you and haunts you even in a different way than you, let's say, watching an Eagles game and the Liberty Mutual ad comes on. It might mess you up for a little bit, but at the end of the day, you're going to move on with your life. But think about if you had actually written it. Do you know what I mean? And you're just anonymous. No one knows who you are. That's got to feel pretty bizarre.
Yeah. And the reason why I keep harping on it is because it's all a black box to me. You know,
one of
those things that I have not, we will sell no wine before it's time, or we don't, whatever it was, we don't make money, we earn it.
Mm.
Or, what's in your wallet?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right.
Are you even asking me that question?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I'm harping on it, because I can think of a million of them and I don't know what any of them mean. Or as I was saying about semiotics, why they are indeed symbols. But let's get back to the book. Well, no, you know what? You were talking about the recession and, you know, Seth gets exited. And you got to put it in your box and take it out. Like when they closed, Lehman
Brothers.
Yeah. And they just, everyone came in and then they just got their box and they were out and the door was locked. What was that? Did you go through that process?
I mean, I was not myself fired. I, you know, when I was working there, I was 22 years old when the recession hit. So I was not making enough for anyone to notice me, to care about firing me, right? Like on the balance sheet, no one, if you get paid so little, it's almost like your best defense because no one's really going to care. But it was, when I was at the agency during the recession, it was like a weekly thing, you know, oh, where's Sam today? Oh, you look at Sam's desk, it's been Windex clean, the placard is gone. Oh, okay, you know, next week, where's Mary? I mean, it just felt that way. So I think it shaped me from an early age, because when you're in your early 20s, and that's what you see. Also, my parents got laid off from the same company that they worked for. So I have, let's say, a healthy distrust of the American corporation's ability to provide for its people. And part of the reason I became a writer was because of that distrust. I knew that eventually, you know, the desk that would be Windex would be mine. Not to mention the fact that I just love creative writing. I wanted to move in a different direction.
Yeah, it was smart too.
Well, it cost me. It's not lucrative, but it has its benefits, you know?
Well, it's like owning a bookstore. I mean, anyone who tells you that bookstore is making a lot of money is lying to you.
Right.
You're just making people happy, which that's a lot more important.
Yeah.
Every day you make people happy. So you go, wow, it's okay. Or make them laugh, you know, happy laughing. But the thing about it is that you just said you weren't noticed, but then like Moon's talking to him and saying exactly the same thing.
Right.
We looked at all the indispensable people, but your name never came up at all.
Yeah.
And so basically on that, I'm not suggesting you're like Seth, but there's things in your life that you pulled for examples in the book, right?
There are, yeah. I mean, after Seth loses his job, I mean, it's not a major spoiler, but after he loses his job, he works as a barista at a coffee shop. I wasn't fired, but when I was in grad school for creative writing, I got a job as a barista. And part of the reason was I needed money. That was the main reason, but also I didn't want to work in branding. I wanted to use my brain, you know, for my own writing, not for taglines. So I thought that working at a coffee shop would be a great way to just sort of use my hands and, you know, I don't know what I thought. I thought that I'd be like writing a novel in between shifts or something. I mean, that didn't happen, but it did find its way into the novel. So on some level it worked, I guess.
Well, it's funny because our bookstore has a cafe too. And I always tell the girls, sometimes they're 15, sometimes they're 16. I would say guys, I guess they're women too. I don't know. I would say guys, but guys suck at being baristas and working in a bookstore. It's a generalization, but so far in 13 years, that's what I found. Oh, except I got a guy working for me and he's going to hear this. Yeah. So
not you, Rick, or not you, Sam, or whatever. You're great. Yeah, you're the exception.
I always tell them, it's great to become a barista because you'll always be able to get a job.
Yeah.
It's a fallback. And the other thing is the latte art, which everyone wants to master. And now they watch YouTube videos to get good latte. But I have, my nephew Graham was working as a barista, and all his latte art was just penises. And I tried to get him to stop, or any something else obscene. But people seem to like it in a strange way. There's a branding. Our cafe.
way to make a name for yourself, Graham.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I saw, you know, talking about the characters, and you got to watch me because I just veer away and then I talk and talk and talk, which is stupid, but I do it. But talk about Moon, because Moon is like the opposite of Seth in a lot of ways, but he has these problems, but he slides by him. And Seth's mom and dad likes Moon a lot better than he likes his son.
Yeah, it seems that way, right?
Yeah, that was really well done.
Yeah. So for folks who haven't read the book, Moon is, you know, Seth is very neurotic. He lacks self-awareness. He's got a big ego, makes a ton of bad decisions in the book, but at least wrestles with the question of, am I a good guy or a bad guy? Like, at least he entertains that. Moon, his former coworker, who's more successful than he is at the agency, he doesn't even bother with the question. He's all ego, all bluster. He's you know, super loud, hooks up with women, doesn't think about it for much time at all. He's sort of like, if folks watch Mad Men, he's kind of that Roger Sterling energy where, you know, he's charismatic and you can't help but take your eyes off, focus on him when he walks into a room, even if you kind of detest him. And their relationship, the Seth and Moon dynamic, was my favorite part of writing this book. Whenever the two of them were on the page together, it just felt electric because Seth resents him so much. You know, how is this guy more successful? He's not as smart as me. He doesn't think as hard as me. But all of us in our careers, we've always found guys like Moon, right? Like, there's always that guy who you look at and you think, why does he have this thing that I want? And he's not, you know, as good as me.
Yeah. And he can skip his father's funeral and still get away with it.
That's right. Right. Right.
Yeah. And in The Stranger by Camus, you don't get away with it. You get executed.
Yeah. Yeah. A little different for him.
One of the funniest things too was a couple of times, and I think I've done this in my life, he takes his own money, the money he gathered when was young. I've forgotten the Yiddish word for it, the Hebrew word for it.
The tzedakah box? Is that what it is?
Yeah. He takes it. But then when he takes the monitor or Moon stuff, he goes, well, it seemed only fair because I took mine, so right, I may as well take his.
Yeah.
And that's his logic. And I'm not saying it seems to work for him, but that's the way he lives, which is reprehensible.
Yeah. Yeah. He rationalizes his behavior all the time. I mean, he basically steals Moon's car. And even though Moon is objectionable in all these ways, I mean, you know, he could press charges. He could do a lot of different things. He doesn't. You know, they're enemies, but they're also best friends, and they need each other, and they even have a kind of homoerotic dynamic to their relationship. I mean, as I say, I just loved writing the two of them because I was in a fraternity in college, and it was always striking to me how, you know, guys would hate each other one day, and then they'd be best friends, and then there'd be rumors of them making out. I mean, it was just as men, sometimes it feels like a lot of dynamics are never out in the open, you know? And so we can only be violent with each other. We can only slap each other on the back. And so it was really fun for me to have those two characters and think through some of that stuff and let them play it out.
Yeah. And the key to that, and I guess a pivotal moment in the book is, and yeah, also because you're a poet, is the poem of sorts that Moon leaves on the top of the toilet, which is really funny. But it contains all those elements, including the erotic element of it. And there is not a reciprocation, but there's something. And the interesting thing about what you said there, and I'll ask you as both a poet and a storyteller, is Seth is yelling at Moon saying, when he says it's story, he goes, no, poems are not stories.
Yeah.
So it's not like Marianne Moore saying a poem should not mean B. So what's the deal with that?
Yeah. You know, it's so funny because originally that poem wasn't written. And I was talking to my uncle, and you know, everyone has as the uncle, right? My uncle who is super nice and takes an interest in my writing, but you know, maybe doesn't know all that much about writing. That's not an indictment of him. That's just not his life. But he asked me, he heard I was writing a novel. He knew that I wrote poems. And so he said, "Oh, are there any poems in the novel?" And I thought to myself, my sweet uncle, right? Like that, it's such a naive question. Like, of course there's no poems in the novel. Like I would, you know, they're two different genres, Uncle Fred. Why would I ever combine them? But then the more I thought about it, because I had written a different note that Moon leaves him. And I thought, well, what if I did turn this into a poem? And because I think that a poem, you know, the question that's running through Seth's mind, because the poem is really explicit. It's really, he reads it and he's like taken aback. He's also aroused by it. But, you know, who writes a poem? Maybe someone in love, maybe someone who is being sentimental or speaking from the heart in a different way. Like you characterize something as a poem and it changes how it's read. So that final exchange between them where they're having the argument about, well, wait, was it a poem or was it just a story? A story, I think, is more lighthearted. If it's a poem, I think Seth is less able to kind of just dismiss it, you know?
Yeah, and it's like what I was talking about in the introduction about portmanteau, which is not right because it's just two things. But the meaning of the poem is like three or four different meanings, you know?
Yeah.
It's insulting. It's comic. Like you said, it's semi-erotic. Yeah, it's got like four or five elements in it in just a few lines on the top of a toilet.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. That was really good. And it's also about value. You just said that because a poem has a different value than a story because you put the brand on it. It's a poem. This is a poem. Where some of your book reads like poetry, but it's not poetry.
Well, I'm just gonna say, I mean, even, you know, in my life, introducing myself, you know, someone says, "What do you do?" If I say I'm a poet, I get a different facial expression response than if I say I'm a writer or even a novelist. Like, poet raises an eyebrow. It's like, who is this guy? You know, is it bongo drums and a beret? Is it, you know, like deep feeling? Is it sappy? Is it like who? Like, it's just, poems and poetry, it occupies a really vaulted but also sort of mocked place in our society. It doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Right.
Whereas if you say you're a writer, it feels safer. Also, I think maybe more masculine, frankly. So, oh, yeah. You know, I was interested, and it was also just a fun way for me to get in a little bit of a wink in the book because I am someone who thinks a lot about poems versus stories. So, you know, it was fun to bring some of that thinking onto the page.
The same thing's true of like, if you go to a party with a bunch of rich people and they're talking about their jobs and the money they've made, and some woman comes up to you and says, "What do you do?" And you say, "You're a bookseller."
Yeah.
Like, you're the best thing in the world.
Yeah. Right. You're like a novelty.
Yeah. If you just go, "I own a bookstore," it's just like everyone gloms around, and I'd never understood why, but it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was this artist who, he did this artwork. It was a cube of gold, but he signed his name in the corner. And I always talk to my kids about it because it's like, where's the value? Is the value in the inherent value of the gold, or is the fact that he branded it and now it's worth more than the gold itself? Mm. What is that? It's perception. Mm. And maybe that's what we're talking about with advertising. It just, is it perception?
Hmm. Yeah.
Is it that? Because that's semiotics.
Well, one of the exchanges in the book that I really had a lot of fun writing was Seth and Moon are talking about branding and what it means. And Moon describes, even though Moon is much more successful, everyone in the book, frankly, is more successful than Seth at branding. And I think part of the reason is because Seth is caught up on, you know, what branding really means, that it matters, that it changes the world, that it has an impact. The other people at the agency, they're not encumbered by any of those kinds of delusions. They can just punch in and punch out and see it much more objectively. So Moon talks about a car company. And, you know, he's like, what even is a brand like Lexus? You got one company that makes the tires. You got one company that makes the battery. You got another company that produces the leather seats. And then you slap all these different components together. And then you put the L logo on it. And that's a Lexus. But it doesn't actually refer to some inherent Lexus entity. It's just the combination of different components that come from different places. And, you know, I don't want to say that that's exactly my viewpoint of branding, but writing it, I was thinking to myself, I agree with them, you know?
Yeah. The only brand, car brand, and it's probably in my mind, the best brand in the world, and he operates his business this way in his life, is Tesla.
Hmm.
It has the best font, and it's so evocative of what was the best and the best potential that ever existed in the world. And he's on that mantle.
Yeah. And, you know, we could talk a lot about Tesla, but it's interesting, right? I mean, we could go on a whole branding conversation about car companies and just a new company that feels fresh. I mean, it immediately makes the other companies feel stale, right? Like a company like Lexus, what are they going to do to catch up? How are they going to reinvent themselves?
They can't. He just builds an incredible car. There's never been a commercial of any kind for a Tesla. And there never will be. And the models don't really have any, the models aren't branded. It's just a letter S or something funny from some movie like Plaid or, you know, anyway, what else was I really? Oh, Yael, the Israeli soldier.
Yeah.
Everyone I know who goes to Israel finds an incredibly hot woman soldier. There's something about it with guys. And if you cast this in a movie, because it is very cinematic, she would be, well, she wouldn't be, but it's just like Gal Gadot, you know? That's how I imagined her in my mind. That same very strong, sexually unobtainable woman.
Yeah. Well, when my character goes on Birthright, I mean, he doesn't know what he's looking for. You know, he's completely, even though he still has his job at that point, he's lost. I mean, he goes on Birthright because the company says, the agency that he works for says, you know, you got to take a vacation day. Like, you're accruing all these vacation days. You got to use them or lose them. And Seth is such an addict for the job. He's so hooked on branding and wants to be partner so badly. You get the sense he'd be happy never taking a vacation day in his life. But if he's going to take a vacation, he might as well make it a free one. And that's what Birthright offers him. Later in the book, as he goes through some degree of transformation, I mean, whether or not he really changes, whether or not there's a real arc, I think that's an open question. But when he gets involved with Chabad later, I think at that point, Judaism and Jewish identity means more to him. But I mean, when he's going to Birthright, yeah, I think he's looking for a good time in all senses and not much more.
Did you ever do that? Did you ever go to Israel?
Yeah, I went on Birthright. Yeah. Yeah. Yes,
there's a lot of stuff in there. Did you hang out with a soldier who was really hot?
Well, I won't answer that, but I mean, you know, I was interested in going on Birthright on the level of branding, honestly. I mean, I wanted to, you know, you go to Israel, that means a lot of different things, but I was interested to see. I went when I was older. I didn't go when I was 18. I went when I was, I think, 24, 25, when I was working at the agency. So I wanted to see what the experience would look like in terms of how a place like Israel gets branded, how it gets represented, what sort of image are they trying to put forward? You know, that was interesting.
Yeah, I think the lowest point for Seth in the book is when he won't go to the Wailing Wall with his mother's prayer and he gives it to someone to take, gives it to her to take. And it reminded me of some book I read where you can, if your dad dies in the United States, you can hire someone in Israel to sit shiva, to do what do you call when you have to do it for a year? You know, the art site.
Take Kaddish?
You have to do that for a year every morning. With them. You can hire someone to do that.
Really? You can? Wow.
And the book is about a guy who did that, and then he feels so horrible that he becomes a devout Jew and goes over to try to apologize to the guy.
Is the book? Do you know the title?
I'll think of it and I'll send it to you.
Yeah, I'd be curious. That's really interesting. That's It'll like be- um, Was it absolutions when you'd buy them from the Catholic Church when you wanted to be forgiven?
Yeah, it's like indulgences. Yeah.
That's what it is. Right. Indulgences. That's interesting.
What about the part where he's driving in the cab on the Sabbath and the Orthodox Jews surround it? Did it?
Well, I was, it did not happen exactly like that, but when I was in Israel, I got really sick in Israel. And so I had to take a car. I don't even remember where exactly, but bottom line is I was in Jerusalem. I found myself in a car on Shabbat and the Orthodox were protesting exactly what we were doing. So they sort of like surrounded our car and I was never in great danger, but it was terrifying. They were beating on the doors of the car. Yeah. So some version of that happened. I mean, listen, the novel is fiction, right? On some level, I want to tell you it's entirely fiction. It's entirely made up, but every fiction writer I know pulls from their experiences in some way. So
I think you have to. I mean, that's the way to write a book. The only other way to write a book, like without doing that, is like James Joyce did in Ulysses in the Nighttown episode, which is how I do it too. I go to a bar and I just sit down and I listen to what everyone's saying and I write it down because it's much better than any dialogue I could write. Well, let's talk about, I just did it again. Let's talk about the epigraphs, because that's another thing. When people come into the bookstore, if they like it, they pick it up and they go through the title page and then there's the epigraphs. And I always think it's important because I figured the author must think a lot about it, because it's like the cover of a jigsaw puzzle, the box. It's like, okay, this is what's going to be inside. Take a look. So where'd you come up? Well, the Vivian Gornick one, she's still around. She's like 88 years old.
Yeah.
Where'd you come up with that one? Why? I don't even know what that one means. The second one by David Ogilvy, I know what it means. The first one, I don't know.
Yeah. So I'll read it for folks. It's right here. But Vivian Gornick's one of my favorite literary critics, Jewish. She's been around for a while. And I was reading, forget what book. I was reading, it's from one of her essays that recently got collected. And the line was, "He was a man. He heard the sound of no voice but his own." When I read that, I just thought, oh, that's my character. He's, unable to really hear the other characters in the book who are telling him to himself, right? Like if you listen to Josie, if you listen to Moon, you get a sense of who Seth is and where his failings are. But because the book is in first person, we only really hear Seth's version of events. And, to me, that felt like it was saying something about my character, but it was also maybe saying something about men more generally, and that inability to hear criticism or to hear others. And then the David Ogilvy, there's no more legendary figure in advertising than Ogilvy. And so the line is, if it doesn't sell, it isn't creative. To me, that line just, that's devastating for someone like Seth, because it just draws such a definitive line. And when he loses his job, if it doesn't sell, it isn't creative. If you can't keep a job in advertising, you're no good at it. And at the end of the day, that's where the line gets drawn for our character.
I think Ogilvy also said, what was it? It's not the ink, it's the think, which is a brand, it's a logo itself, but
right.
Seth does do that.
Hmm.
He spends a lot of time thinking.
Yeah, maybe too much.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Oh, that reminds me of another thing. There's one time in the book, which is not really a spoiler. I can frame it so it's not a spoiler, where you go, wait a minute. Like you said, it's in the first person. Is he a completely unreliable narrator?
Mm.
The one point when you realize, and may very well be true, is when he looks back and what he wrote has disappeared.
Yeah. Yeah.
As soon as I read that, I go, oh, no. Well, and the pills. But yeah, right. Did you mean to do that? Because how did that happen otherwise?
Yeah. I mean, I think reading this guy, you're going to feel a range of things, right? You're going to probably laugh out loud at moments. You're going to sort of be horrified by some of his decisions, but you're also going to question him at times, because he's so warped. His mind is so, and I think one of the questions that the book doesn't address, but that readers are free to speculate on, is if this stupid adult diaper thing hadn't gone viral, would he be as messed up in the head? Do you know what I'm saying? It's like what they say about early fame, right? Like if you hit it big early on, it can really distort you for the rest of your career. And I think that Seth, he's sort of a one-hit wonder. He's like one of those bands who hit the Billboard charts and then you never heard from again. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because it was like when Jennifer Lawrence won the Oscar and some dumb reporter goes, "Do you think you've peaked too early?"
And oh, really?
Yeah. And everyone, she was 21 and everyone laughed and she like rolled her eyes at him. And then I thought, well, God, maybe he was right.
Maybe still an unfair question, but yeah.
The other thing is, and that's the other thing, you're writing this book at a time where going viral pretty much means everything. I mean, like even in the book, what if someone did 5,000 likes already, but who did that? I forgot. They did something, they went, oh, 5,000 likes. But anyway, yeah, so going viral, getting a million, you know, if this YouTube video gets a million likes, you're going to be like telling everybody because it's going to get a million likes.
We'll see if that happens, but yes.
It'll get like 10,000. Shouldn't say that. Oh, man. I'm so tired because of you. You've really irritated me because I stayed up till 5 o'clock in the morning because of you.
But you're welcome. What? Yeah. It's a really nice night we spent together. Yeah.
Great. The other thing you do is there's a lot of characters in the book. You don't think it at first, but there really is. So you take this kid, Asher, right? Asher?
Yeah.
You know, you give him a couple of pages of being there. But when you're done with the book, you're kind of like, you know, first of all, you really like the kid a lot because he tolerates Seth and Seth does some stuff to him that's really bad, but he tolerates him and he likes him. And then he's gone.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of characters in the book that do unlikable things, but Asher, the little boy, you know, who has pretty serious illness, he's unimpeachably cute. And I think, you know, that's one of the things I have two young kids. That's one of the amazing things about kids. There are some difficult things, but one of the amazing things is like, yeah, Seth shows up at the house and Asher just, you know, it's fun, right? It's fun when someone new comes into the house and he just loves it. He doesn't care about Seth's ego or all the mistakes he's made or the fact that he's effectively sleeping out of his car or Moon's car, really. He just is excited to have kind of like this big brother to hang out with. So I think for me, Asher, those scenes, you know, that's where a lot of the heart of the book is in their relationship.
It's really interesting. I really liked Moon as a person a lot because he was so forgiving. Like if he stole my car like he did, I'd be like, well, being me, maybe being Jewish, I'd be like plotzing. You know? I'd be like going crazy. I'd call the police and all that. And he doesn't care.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. He jumped
out in the window and all that. Yeah. I like him. And, you know, I'd like to say, because it seems right, I'd like to say that I like Seth, but I don't.
Yeah.
But there's something in the back of your head, in the very back of your head, that maybe feels like, yeah, why would you like him? Where's the redeeming quality? What are his redeeming qualities?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that I mentioned to on another podcast that I was on was that I had a friend of mine was reading the book recently and he was texting me and he goes, you know, Seth, your main character, he's so unlikable. He makes all these terrible decisions. You know, I'm really like, he's an anti-hero, right? I'm supposed to root against him. And his wife was simultaneously reading the book and she was texting me, I love Seth. I think he's so funny. He's so charming. You know, I love being in his head. And I was just enjoying the split screen of the text messages, right? Because to me, he's both. I would not want to spend this many pages with a character who I found totally unlikable and irredeemable. I think that Seth has a desire to be good. I think that he wants to save the people around him, actually. I think he is sincere in, like, is he just a stalker when he goes after Ramya? You could say yes, but I think that he actually does care about her in some way. And I think he has that going on for a few different characters in the book, but he's just such a fuck up and it's hard to love him at the same time. And I like characters like that. You know, they feel real to me.
Oh, me too. It just depends on, you know what? He's not evil.
Yeah.
He's not an evil person.
Right, right.
Some of the funny things aren't even characters. Like the monitor plays a big part in the book.
Yeah.
It's just a monitor.
Yeah.
And another funny thing was when he goes back to Josie's office and then he goes, maybe her monitor is bigger.
Right.
Like, where the hell do you come up with that? But it's really funny, you know? It's like, why is that even funny? But it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what you're saying about your friend and his wife
is
like, if this book goes into our fiction book club, mm-hmm. I've said this before on the show many times, it's like, I call it Fight Club.
Yeah.
Because you'll have people, I always think of them as being on the other side of the table, and one of them's going to go, you know, Seth, why would he even put Seth in there? He's such an, you know, asshole. And then the other one's going to go, how can you say that? I mean, and that's the whole idea of writing a book, right?
Right, right. Yeah, I'd like to think so. I mean, listen, I don't want to read a book where everyone is just a goody two-shoes doing the right thing, saying the right thing, thinking the right thing all the time. I mean, who wants that?
Nope. Well, some people do want that.
Unfortunately, most of America. But, well, but you know, for the rest of us, you know?
Yeah, it's like these books by this woman, Colleen Hoover. She got like 6 books on the bestseller and they're horrible. And I have the luxury of being able to say, no, we're not having that book in the store. Or Spare by Prince Harry. No, we're not selling that. Just no.
Yeah.
Or James Patterson. It's great. I can just say, no, I'm not selling it. And they come in and ask for it. And no, we don't have it.
Yeah.
it's what it is this. Like, and I've said this before too, my brother, he likes books that, you know, at the end, they're in a box with wrapping paper and a ribbon on top, and that's it. But I like books, and you like books that, like, when you're done, you're not done. Like, it's not just that we're talking about it. Of course, I just read it 5 hours ago. But but I'll think about it for a while because, you know, you worry about yourself. You think about Moon, and then you go, and you think about the industry, and then you think about, okay, love that chicken from Popeyes, that we are farmers. Just that's what I'm doing. Like, that's, you're in my head about that now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you meant to do that, but I mean, yeah, I'm going to be thinking about slogans for a long time. Brands.
I think, you know, in a weird way, it's like, it's the greatest honor, you saying that, because that was in some level the intention. When I was working at the agency, I was just thinking about it all the time. That we get bombarded with language and imagery. And, you know, you were talking about semiotics. I mean, I read a lot of Derrida in college. I was that nerd. And so what does a word mean? What is the referent? What, you know, how is language being used? How is it being neutered on some level? All of those considerations went into the book, even if I wasn't conscious of it. So I love the idea that a reader would step into the world of book of the book that I wrote and then think differently maybe about the commercials that get thrown at them on a daily level. I think that would be good.
I don't think you can help it. I mean, if you read the book as a good reader, which I have, I don't think you could help it because they're all evocative from page one. Because you go, okay, you go, wait a minute, why would this win an award? And then you go, well, you know. But then the reason why it would win an award, in my opinion, is because of exactly what you didn't do. You weren't the person who had him touch the tree and look at it lovingly. So maybe the tag refers back. Does it? Does it always refer back to the content? It's that, there you go. There's content. And then there's what you did.
Yeah.
Difference.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that, you know, I know we got to wrap up soon, but one of the things that I loved working at the agency, because I've talked a lot about what I didn't like, but what I loved was working with a designer, right? Because a good relationship between a copywriter and a designer, that can be it can be like making art. It can be an ecstatic collaboration because they design something and then you write a line to it. And then they change their design based on what you've written. And then you edit the line. And it, you know, in a good ad, there's a nice tension between what you're seeing visually and what you're reading verbally. And sometimes with a book cover, the book will be titled The Fish. And then on the cover, you get an image of a fish. And even if it's the most beautiful cover in the world, I look at it and I think, meh, where's the heat? Like, where's the interest? You know, what'd you say?
And you don't buy the book.
Yeah, you don't buy the book. One of my favorite covers in recent years was Bauteman's The Idiot, where you have the pink background and then the image of the rock. And it's like, your brain is like, oh, I guess an idiot is, you know, dumb as rocks, right? Like you make that connection, but there's a little bit of a leap. With this book, and here's where I sell the book one more time, you know, The Men Can't Be Saved. I didn't want just a photo of men falling off a cliff. I liked the idea of there being some tension between what you're seeing visually and what the line says, right? So I think a good ad makes your brain do a little bit of work, but not too much that you can't connect the two.
Right. Yeah, there has to be something they have to work. They have to work together. One is one thing. Yeah. One has, I don't know. Maybe one has value, one doesn't. I can't really explain it. But you're sick of me anyway, because you're saying you have to end. Because I'll just keep talking all day long. But okay, so in conclusion, I would ask you, Ben, like, are you going to be a poet? Are you going to be a novelist? What's the next thing? Yeah, here's the classic Terry Gross question. So what are you working on now?
Right. In the long run, I'm going to be like that skeleton behind you. That's ultimately what I have planned.
Well, yeah, it's going to happen to me a lot quicker than you.
There's this, well, who knows, right? There's this poem that I love. And one of the lines of it is, where do you see yourself in the next 5 to 10,000 years? Which like sort of epitomizes the book on some level, like that, you know, HR speak that just is meaningless. We're all going to the same place. I like doing both. I like writing poems. I got a new novel that I'm just in the early phases of writing. What I don't want to do, frankly, is brand myself. I don't want to just write the same book. Yeah, I don't want to just write the same book over and over. There are some authors who do that and that's their thing and good for them, Colleen Hoover. But I'd rather try to reinvent or challenge myself or stretch myself with a new project. So part of why I wanted to write a novel was because it was new. And hopefully that'll be more of what's ahead, just different writing projects that go in different directions.
It's fun, you know, having what I like to say is serial careers. I mean, I practiced law I still do, but like for 30 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was a trial lawyer. So I'm not doing this. I'm telling another story. It's going to take 10 minutes. Ridiculous. Okay, Ben. Thank you so much. I'm not usually this bad, but again, because of you, I haven't slept. So
that's the greatest. That should be the blurb. I stayed up till 5 a.m. reading this book. That tells me something.
Yes. You start out, I hate Ben. There's perfect. I hate Ben. And you go, oh, I wonder why. And this, why is he blurbing it that way? Why? That's a good one.
That's good. That's good advertising.
Maybe that'll be my next one. I talk too much. Well, can't do it. Okay. Anyway, thanks a lot. So thanks so much. The book's going to be on our front table and hopefully it will be a book club pick. And hopefully I can boost this YouTube video so you get some views.
I appreciate it. Hey, listen, thanks for the questions. I know you read the book in the middle of the night, but it's clear that it made a mark and I love the conversation. So thank you.
Yeah. Pleasure. Talk to you soon. All right.
Take care. You.